From the land to Grand Hyatt River City in Urbana, Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the 26th day of August, 2026. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up, we'll discuss the commodity markets with Greg Johnson. We'll take up the weather forecast with Drew Lerner. And we'll hear how Dolly Parton's Imagination Library has impacted the life and family of one of the brokers you hear regularly right here on Illinois Public Media.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, September corn for the day settled the nearby contract 13.5 cents higher at $5.14. December at $5.36.5, up 13 in the March, up 12.25. New crop there at $5.50.75 on its settlement price. September beans 26.25 cents higher, finished at $12.54.25. November at $12.66, up 28.25, and January soybeans at $12.80.75, 28.5 cents higher. Bean meal $8.40 higher. The bean oil down 30 cents for the day. Wheat futures, where the action really took place, up 45 cents at $7.48.25 in the December. That is a limit move for the afternoon. Greg Johnson from TGM Total Grain Marketing now joins us to take a look at what's been happening in the marketplace. Are you busy there again today in the elevator, Greg?
We are. We're seeing farmers reward this rally, selling mainly old crop corn, but a little bit of new crop corn and a few new crop beans as well. We've been out of old crop beans for quite some time, so we're not buying any old crop beans to speak of. But the other three commodities, farmers are taking advantage of this rally to some extent. Not selling lots, afraid that it's going to keep going higher, but I think they are willing to reward the market and let loose of a little bit at these prices.
How much of a rally have we had in corn?
Back on June 30th, we were 430. December corn was 430. Today we're at 534. So just over a dollar rally in the corn. New crop beans, the November contract was 1120 back on June 30th. And in less than 2 months' time, we're now at 1250. That's a $1.30 gain. And the wheat, July 27 wheat was 630. Back on June 30th, and now it's $7.50. So that's a $1.20 rally. So over a dollar or more rally in all three of the major commodities.
By the ratios there, corn seems like it's the most impressive rally. I do want to throw out some things you can discuss as it's related to this corn rally. I think they're all supply side. The first one was the really dry, droughty weather in Paris, parts of Western Europe that impacted the corn crop there. And then, of course, we have the war in the Black Sea and the increase in the fighting there as it's related to their port system, both Russia and Ukraine. And finally, the United States corn crop, particularly the pro-farmer numbers as they were released. I think I got all of those correct. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree 100% on the pro-farmer. That is a supply-driven reduction in the crop. Now, I would, you know, you can argue that a reduction in the supply of the French and German and Spanish corn crop and a reduction in the exports out of Ukraine and Russia would translate into increased demand here out of the U.S. because if you can't get the crop from France or Ukraine like you normally do, you're going to have to buy it from somewhere. So smaller supply could lead to increased demand on those first two points, but there's no doubt that the pro-farmer here in the U.S., that's a definite supply reduction. And just to, keep people from, saying the sky is the limit, Pioneer did a survey they do every year in the state of Iowa, where they're located. And they had over 4,000 samples of corn, so it wasn't just a few areas here and there, is pretty much the entire state. They came up with a 226 average, which is 1% less than a year ago, but it's way higher than the 194 that Pro Farmer is using for Iowa. So I just think that's something to keep in mind, that the route that Pro Farmer takes has a lot to do, I think, do with their final numbers. And I understand why they came up with those numbers. For example, here in Illinois, they went through some of the wettest areas, that central I-74 corridor, and then up along Route 24 through the Quad Cities. That those were some areas that received some heavy rain, and not only rain here in August, but one thing that I think we need to remember is we had heavy rains in June. And I think that those heavy rains in June, we lost some nitrogen at that point. And so I think that's a big reason for the reduction of the crop in central Illinois, central Indiana. But again, a reduction is not a disaster. I think if your corn didn't drown out or get blown over by the wind or the tornadoes, there's some decent corn out there. You know, maybe, you know, a little bit less than average or right at average. Certainly not the, you know, the big yields that we're expecting, but I think it's an average crop. And so, you know, Pro Farmer, I think, hit it on the head when they said the crop is not as good as what it looks like from the field. I would agree with that, but it probably isn't as low as what they said either, because I don't think the entire state got hit by the wet weather in June and August like we did here through central Illinois and central Indiana.
And as a reminder, their number is about 188 bushels when you take the differential with it was 184 on the tour. For what it's worth, the agronomists on campus at the OVI still say this is a good crop and in that 212 range from USDA. We'll see what that looks like over time. We'll know more when the September report comes out. Soybeans, what should we talk about with them today?
The soybeans have been under, they haven't rallied as much. I don't want to say they're under pressure because they've gone up. But like you said, percentage-wise, they have not gone up as much as what corn has. A little bit of pressure on soybeans is coming from the EPA talk about exempting small refineries. That would hurt the soybean oil price a little bit. But I think the bottom line with soybeans is China. They continue to buy soybeans. We see these flash sales about every 2 or 3 days. And by my calculation, they're up close to 50% of the 25 million metric tons that they are expected to buy. And that 25 million is in the, it's cooked into the supply and demand tables already. But the fact that they're making progress towards that 25 million metric tons, I think, is a good sign. And now we'll just have to wait and see after President Trump and President Xi talk. You know, will they use some of that money for other commodities? Will they continue to buy beans? Will they buy more beans than the 25 million or less? So I think China is a big wild card. You know, we kind of talked about that the supply side of the rally is about probably coming to an end as we start to get a handle on what we think is and isn't out there. So if it's going to continue, we're going to have to see some demand, and China might be the biggest wild card when it comes to that demand side of the equation.
Here's a fact that will really throw you, and I did not get a chance to ask Gary Schnittke because he and I were not in the same room yesterday when I was hosting an event in Southern Illinois in Mount Vernon. The PowerPoint slide that he put up showed the percent of soybean imports that the United States represented, I think it was for the current marketing year. It had to be, frankly, over time. And so if you go back to the first Trump administration, the low was 18% for a marketing year. And this time around, it is now at 19% for the marketing year. So what that tells me is, given our demand structure, that there's a lot of demand coming from someplace else underpinning this marketplace for soybeans. And it's domestic demand.
Yes, it's the renewable crush, the renewable biodiesel mandate. I don't think there's any doubt about that, because soybean oil has been leading the way all along. If it was soybean demand, it would be, you know, soybean meal would be the leader, but soybean oil is the leader of the bean market. So I think you can pin that right on the renewable biodiesel mandate.
I will see Gary tomorrow for a webinar that everybody can watch. It's about cash rents, by the way, and the price of farmland at 11 o'clock, farmdocdaily.illinois.edu, under the webinar section where you can watch that. I'll talk to him either before or after that webinar and try to get some clarification on what that number really means and what demand from his point of view looks like for soybeans. Anything else before I let you go for the day?
I think I just want to remind producers that we're now in profitable territory. So, I mean, we've got a little bit of cushion. We don't have to, try to hit the high of the market. If it sells off, if we wait too long, we can still sell corn and beans a little bit lower and make money. So I understand why we want to wait. But I think the thing to remember is farmers are still historically undersold, even with the recent selling that they've done. I still think we're under 30% sold for new crop corn and soybeans. And so usually when the farmers are undersold like this, the market doesn't rally. So this is a very unusual opportunity, and maybe one that farmers should take advantage of to some extent. I still am friendly corn prices. I still think the demand side of the equation could give us the next leg up. But if you need to sell grain and don't want to pay storage charges, and if you can't wait till next January or February, these are definitely profitable levels, and we probably should take a look at getting something sold at these levels anyway.
Hey, thank you much, Greg.
Hey, thank you, Todd.
You're welcome. Greg Johnson is with TGM. You're listening to the Closing Market Report on this Wednesday afternoon. Up next, Dolly Parton's cultural impact. It extends far beyond her country music. She's also responsible for helping to lift her hometown in the Smoky Mountains out of poverty and gifting millions of books to children. Dolly Parton's music gave her the financial resources to take care of her people in Pigeon Forge and help to raise that region of the Smoky Mountains out of poverty, wrote to Garrett Toy from Stockton, Illinois, on his X account. She helped his family, too, he says, through her charitable organization, Imagination Library. I asked him about it.
In our local area, she works with local banks that helps facilitate the project, but basically, for any child from the age of birth to the age of five, once they start school, you sign up for the program and you get a free book every month until you turn age five and start kindergarten or preschool. And she did that to honor her father, who didn't know how to read. So she's done this, I don't know the exact numbers, but she's bought millions of books for children. My children participated in it. It's available to anybody. And if it's not available in your community and you might be a community leader, or know somebody at a bank to help facilitate, the program, but they donate a ton of money to these programs to help, teach children to read.
How are you involved, or are you?
Well, I'm not involved personally. We just benefited from it, for my children. But, I think my wife had heard about it online. My wife, Bridget is a huge Dolly Parton fan. In fact, on vacation this year, we went to the Pigeon Forge and went to Dollywood. That was our vacation this year. So she's been a huge fan. So she had heard about it somewhere online. I was not familiar with it at all until my wife had mentioned it to me.
How do you think it benefited your children?
Well, it got them reading at an early age. I mean, it made that priority. And you know, going to the library is one thing, having a library card. Yes, that's free. But you got to return that book, and the fact that she's giving you a book with no obligation whatsoever, and that had a friend on X made the comment, he's like, his daughter's book is still sitting on the shelf, and it's something that they own, and helps create reading as a priority.
And that was important enough that you really wanted to make a comment on X about it.
You know, she lived her life with a big heart and strong hands. And if we had more of that today, we'd be all in a lot better place than where we are, you know. So when she climbed the ladder, she made sure that she didn't lift it up behind her. She let others in her area climb that ladder as well.
That's Garrett Toy from AgTraderTalk.com. He's a farmer and a commodity broker in Stockton, Illinois. Over the last 31 years, Dolly Parton's Imagination Library has gifted more than 330 million books across five different countries. Let's turn our attention now to the weather forecast for the growing regions across the planet. Drew Lerner is here for this Wednesday, as usual, from World Weather Incorporated. He's in Kansas City, Missouri. Thank you, Drew, for being with us. Let's begin in South America, the center west of Brazil, where they cannot plant a soybean because of Asian soybean rust until at least September the 1st, though they'll need more rainfall or any rainfall to get that started. What are their prospects?
That's right. That's right. They don't get enough rain in the off season to put any kind of or keep any kind of moisture in the soil. They just bake themselves dry, and then that's where we are right now. But there is a difference in the model data the last few days. suggesting that there will be some scattered showers that will evolve. And most of these are going to be light, but that's the way you start. So that's okay. The first opportunity for rain will probably evolve around midweek next week, maybe Tuesday into Thursday. There'll be some scattered showers and some thunderstorms occurring. Now, this is mid-latitude frontal boundary activity. This is not monsoonal moisture or subtropical moisture coming out of the Amazon, anything like that. So I did notice that the southern hemisphere's jet stream is farther north than it should be at this time of the year. And so the frontal systems like this may occur over the next 10 days or so, and we may see other opportunities for scattered showers. And if that's the case, some of these producers may go ahead and start making some effort to get into the fields. Most likely that's going to be closer to mid-September, because it'll take a little while to get that first moisture into the ground to stay. So, but anyway, it's a little bit different than it was a week ago when it looked like it was going to be dry for quite a while.
Beginning of the season for those in South America, end of the season here in the United States. We have heard, of course, about dry down coming fairly quickly in some places. What do you think the weather will bring us across the Corn Belt for the next 10 days or so?
Well, you know, it's kind of interesting. I went back and took a hard look at some of the other stronger El Nino events that we've had. And in most of those years, there was a tendency for September and to some degree early October. I said that wrong. Actually, it's August and September weather to be drier biased in the western Corn Belt. And that would be parts of Iowa, Missouri, Kansas, Nebraska, to a lesser degree farther north, but it did show a little bit in southern Minnesota and southeastern South Dakota. So if we're going to follow some of these other years, there's a potential we may be drier biased over the next 30 days. It will not be absolutely dry, though. I want to make sure I make that clear. There will be some showers around, but it's probably going to be lighter than usual rain in those areas. And we're probably because that we have that drier bias, it's coming from that persistent high pressure ridge, which had been in the Rocky Mountains. And as it shifts more into the central and southern plains, we will see a persistence of not only that drier tendency, but also will put more heat into the southern plains. Texas and Oklahoma, of course, have had temperatures near over 100 for, probably about 35, 40 days. And that could continue for a little while. We have a little break over these next two or three days. It's going to be a little showery down that way, but not enough rain to make a big difference. And the temperature will come down into the 90s, maybe a couple of upper 80s for two or three days, and then we'll turn right around and go back into the 100-degree temperatures coming up. So I think the central U.S. is kind of headed back into the same realm that it's been in, but a short-term break here, near-term.
Any differences between the western and southwestern areas and the Delta region or the eastern part of the Corn Belt?
For those areas, it doesn't look tremendously different. I do think we'll get away from the excessive rains that have plagued Indiana and Ohio for a while here recently. We've already seen some improvement, but it will continue to rain off and on in that area. I don't think the volume of rain will be what it was, but we are going to still have a slight milder temperature regime in September, and we're still going to get some shower activity. So we're going to be a little slow drying some of those areas out that are still excessively wet, but it will be a process that will move in the right direction. I would really like to see those temperatures about 10 degrees warmer for a week and a half. I think the soybean crop would eat that up and we would get rid of a lot of that excess moisture. But as of today, I don't see that coming up.
Now, you discussed earlier that you were doing some studies looking at previous El Niños. Did you take a look at that across the planet, and what did it show if that was the case?
Yeah, it was kind of an entertaining little study. Of course, I'm a meteorologist, and I get a little weird relative to the general public, but what excites us is a little different from everybody else. But I did take the most significant recent, very strong or super El Nino events of the past and took a look at the vegetative health indexes for those years as of mid-August and compared it to this year. It was very revealing. What I found, first of all, those other years are 1982, 1997, 2015, and then, of course, this year. Oh, 1965 is in there as well. The vegetative health indexes, they weren't doing those prior to 1982, so I can't look at 1965 from that study. But what I found is that most of the Asian countries, India, certainly Vietnam, Thailand, Cambodia, the Philippines, and Indonesia, Malaysia, those areas were all seriously dry by mid-August in each of those events, but in particular 1982 and 1997. 2015, which was the most recent El Nino, wasn't nearly as adverse on those crop areas in Southeast Asia or even India as they were in 1982 or 1997. And when we look at the vegetative health index today, even though Indonesia is doing very poorly with rain, the health index is still much better than these other years. And the reason is all that La Nina-related rainfall that we had for the past couple of years, and that there's been a lot of moisture in the ground that's really helped carry these crops for a while.
Interesting. Did you look at the U.S. at all?
I did. And in fact, one of the things that I looked at besides the U.S. was also Western Europe, because the media has been has had a tendency to blame the big bad drought in France and Western Europe on El Nino, and the same for the excessive heat and dryness that we've had in the Rocky Mountain region and the plains this summer. And the reality is that in the case of Europe, the drought there was already underway a year ago, and it was fairly hot in the summer of 2025. We took a little break over the winter, but it came back on strong this year. And typically, El Nino, super El Ninos in particular, tend to make Western Europe wetter biased rather than drier biased. So we can't hook the drought this year in Europe with this super El Nino event that's underway. And in the Western United States, the excessive heat that has occurred in the dryness is coming largely from that absence of snow that we had in the spring. If you recall, most of the Rocky Mountains lost all of their snow cover early in the latter part of winter, and in the spring there was none out there, and so the soil temperatures got a lot hotter a lot sooner. So when our seasonal ridge of high pressure developed, everything just kind of perpetuated on itself, and we ended up with much warmer temperatures. When we go back and look at El Nino events of the past, the Western United States typically is wetter than normal in the summer. However, there is a tendency for temperatures to be warm biased in the West, but not as excessively hot as they were this year. So that's one of the reasons why I blame the excessive heat more on the lack of snow cover during the late winter and early spring.
Hey, thank you so much for the information. I really appreciate it. We'll talk with you again next week.
You bet. Take care now.
You too. Drew Lerner is with World Weather Incorporated in Kansas City and joined us on this Wednesday edition of the Closing Market Report that came to you from Illinois Public Media, online, on demand at WILLAG.org. You have a good afternoon. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason.